Welcome to episode 68 of the Giraffe Lab podcast, brought to you by MTGAZone.com. I'm your host, Josh Phillips, aka J-Twist Josh, where I have once again been abandoned by the side of the road by all-time 17 lands trophy leader, Cranky Chris Palmiotti, as he's currently on tour after his recent victory in the Santa Gator pageant. So I had to make a last-minute call. Okay, let's be real, it was Discord. Nobody calls anyone anymore. To the one who gives the best Joes to his Johns. That's right, Joe John Random Numbers has returned. This week's subject is winning by just enough. How's it going today?
Going well. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm great.
Nice.
Bounty, strangely enough, no one managed to trigger the door to nothingness off of Rymo's Dragon Engine. I'm disappointed in you all. I can't believe you all left me hanging. So I'll give you a simpler one this week so you can collect that sweet prize. All you have to do is attack for lethal with an animated portal to Phyrexia. It actually has to connect with the face as part of the lethal. No almost here.
That's pretty difficult, given that you have to have a Portal of Phyrexia in play and have your opponent not concede before that happens.
I want the screenshots. You want to do a pack one, pick one?
Sure.
All right, we're going to skip a bunch of the draft chaff, because if you don't know not to take Wasteful Harvest, I don't know what to tell you. First up, the retro artifact, Burnished Heart.
So I'm not really that big on this in this format. It's too mana inefficient, I think, to be doing versus a lot of the aggressive strategies that exist. And I don't think that there are good enough payoffs for the really expensive mana stuff. I'm just not so high on it. I think I'm yet to play one this format, so hopefully not picking this.
I kind of have to try cards out, even if I don't think they're good for the format, just so I can report back to everybody. And sad. I was not happy with this one. It was heartbreaking.
Huh.
See what I did there?
Yeah, I'm clever. Yeah.
Maybe if you could put damage on a stack, it might be something, but here, it's just too slow.
Damage on the stack.
Old. I'm old, okay? All right, next, Deadly Riposte.
Yeah, this card, again, I'm certainly not hoping to first pick it, but I think it is a playable card. There's versions of blue-white that take a little setup sometimes, where you're either doing more of the Flyers thing than the Curve Out Soldier thing, or where you have more of a game plan of setting up artifacts and Might Zone animationing in, like, blue-white. And so, yeah, I don't want this really in, like, my Curve Out decks, where I'm just turning all my creatures sideways with combat tricks. There is a place for it.
Yeah, it's a great sideboard card, especially, like, if you're on the draw in an aggro and aggro match, but as a main deck card or a best of one card, it's really, you have to be in one of those decks that's trying to set up and really vulnerable to cheap creatures to want this.
Agree.
How about Disenchant?
Disenchant, I actually like a fair bit. I'm certainly willing to play one in the main deck. Yeah, there's going to be times where it's clunky, but the upside is really there. If you just have straight up a 2-mana instant speed removal spell for something, that's incredible, right? And yeah, it's not going to always have great hits. I usually think that it has something to hit. And so yeah, I'm okay with it. Again, not first pickable, but a playable card and something that I usually am happy to have one of.
Yeah, we had a talk about this last week, and while clearly it's not a first pickable card, I always like having one in my main. It's kind of like an inverse go for the throat in that sometimes it doesn't kill necessarily what you want, but it's still a 2-mana instant speed removal spell for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. I think also something too is there are cards in some versions of white decks that incidentally you want to be playing Rummage or Loot or something just by themselves. And the fact that those cards exist in the format, like Bitter Reunion or Mutt, means that if you're playing them in paired with white cards and you happen to have a Disenchant, the downside is slightly mitigated by the fact that you incidentally have ways to loot it away.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the problem on this card is that people just throw it at the first thing they see. They're like, oh, this fits into my curve. I can just kill that thing right there. And it's like, no, you don't want to kill their Scrapwork cohort.
True.
If it's so you can force through lethal, great. But most likely you're going to have a better target at some point.
Agree.
Skipping all the way to the uncommons, Mask of the Jade Crafter.
Yeah, this is one I like. I think there are versions of the big green deck where you're going to have the Power Stones and stuff, or like green red, there's a Power Stone version of that. And yeah, it's just solid value. You get two bodies from it. Usually one of them at least is fairly large, oftentimes both of them, depending on how you construct your deck. So far, this is the pick for me.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I picked this pack because I love all three of the uncommons in this pack.
Nice.
Mask of the Jade Crafter, like you said, it just makes two huge bodies, and that can be a lot in this format. Because it's like, hey, great, I can deal with that 1/7/7, but then you get another 5/5 out of it too?
Yeah.
And so that can put a huge swing. Every time I've had this card, it's been absurd.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I've liked it.
It's got such modality to it as well, because there's times when you just need to play this and make a 1/1 really quick.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need a chump blocker, or then you can win through the air or something dumb like that. But it does a lot, and it's very versatile.
Agree.
It would be the easy pick right now. Mishra's Research Desk.
Oh yeah, Desk is great too. It just does so much. It's an artifact for when that matters. It's not just value, but also card selection for pretty low cost. Again, the fact that it's an artifact sometimes is relevant. You can have stuff like where you sack it to like a Junkyard Genius or like a Strong Bowl just to finish someone off. The card's just awesome. The fact that you can activate it instant speed too and it lasts to your next turn. All these things just make it, I think, the best version of this kind of card that I've seen, at least that I can remember. And for me, I would probably take it over Mask, both just because I think it's a comparable power level and I do have a preference for the decks that Desk is good in. And yeah, it's just really impressed me.
Yeah, agree with all those points. I am a huge fan of the Desk, and I do think it and Mask are pretty similar, but I think that there are decks where I'm only going to be okay with playing Mask, and I'm playing Desk in so many decks. I love Mono Red if I can ever pull it off. It goes great in there, goes great in any kind of Boros deck, Red Green, and like with Mask, like I said, if you're like super aggro, you don't want that card. Mm-hmm. But with Desk, you want an either an aggro deck or a control deck.
Absolutely.
Next one, Bushwhack.
This one, I think, I haven't gotten to play it that much. I have ran it a couple of times. The fight component of it, just the way the creatures are statted, is not often super exciting. If you happen to be in like the big green version, obviously the fight gets a little better. And it's smoothing your draws so that, you know, you have less mana problems is a nice effect to have on like a one mana fight spell. For me, a clear step below the other two uncommons, but still like not a bad card. I will say that I haven't really been splashing very much in the format. Most of my decks have just been straight two color with a very rare splash, but when I do splash, it does tend to be maybe something green based with Stalwarts. And in those decks, having access to a relevant spell that can also fix my mana can be nice. So like, I think it does help facilitate the splashes, even though that's not typically where I want to be.
Yeah, I think this is one of the ones the stats does not do it justice, but I also agree that it is a step below Desk and Mask. While above any of the commons in the pack we discuss. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's just an MDFC that can be a fight spell. You just replace a land with it, and you're good. That's what it should be done, but I think people don't take that into account when they just throw it in their deck and play it normally.
Anything that's just blanket objectively great whenever you cast it, I think is going to have more reliable stats than things that require a little more nuance, yeah.
And that brings us to our rare Clay Champion.
Is that the one with the white and the green and the casting and stuff?
Yes. Yes, it is. Do you need me to read it?
No, I think I remember. Yeah, this card is a potentially powerful card. The thing is that it requires something of you when you deck build to maximize this card. And so I think that even though it's like a colorless card, it's fairly narrow. And for that reason, I'm not super high in picking it up early. It's not so powerful that I think you want to force a color in order to be in it. Like, it's not like you open like a Titania's Command, you're like, okay, I guess I'm green now. It doesn't have that level of power in my experience. It requires a lot of you to make it as good as it can be. So I'm okay to have it. I could pick it out of some weaker packs or pick it up a little later in the draft if it's floating around and I happen to be in those colors. And I'd be happy to have it in those scenarios, but I'm not super excited to take it pick one. I think I'd rather have the Desk and also the Mask over it.
Yeah, it's kind of odd because like you said, it's a colorless card, but it really requires a lot of setup. And it's pretty much saying you need to be green-white or you need to be almost mono of one of them to maximize the effect of this. Because if you're just like, oh, hey, it's a 5/5 for green 2. That's fine. We're long past the days where Juzum Jin was all about it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's okay. I think I'd rather have Desk than that, though. So if I was already green-white, like instead of this was like a pack 2 pick 1, and I was already set in green-white, I would take this over the other cards. But pack 1 pick 1, I think Desk is the safest pick.
Totally agree.
And one of the other things is because how many times you play a Lens or something like that in your deck? They make the cut a lot. So even if you're not red or green, you could play Desk or Mask and just be happy with the initial effect. And then it's a bonus if you get to flash it back later. Mm-hmm. While with this, if you end up in red, black, you just can't play this.
You're not into 4-mana 2/2s?
They don't really do it for me.
Okay.
So I think the lack of commitment here makes those two better.
Yeah, I agree.
But I would still take it over Bushwhack, I think.
Yes, also agree.
All right, cool. There we go. That was pretty easy.
Nice.
All right. So basically, I hit him up last minute and got him to come on here. I was like, do you have an idea for an episode? Because we can't do the episode I had set up. We'd really like to thank him for coming on here.
We'll do our best.
You want to talk about winning by 1%. Like, that consistently winning by a little is much more valuable than inconsistently winning by a lot.
I believe it was the great philosopher Dominic Toretto who said, it doesn't matter if you win by an inch or a mile, winning's winning.
I thought he said, I am Groot.
I'm pretty sure he said that too, the lesser known quote. And so the idea being that there is real value in the skill of trying to assess how much you really need to win a game of Magic and then kind of adjusting your strategy based on that assessment. And I think it can be difficult. I think that sometimes everyone can get it wrong, but if you don't know that that discussion should happen, then, you know, it's something that can get overlooked very easily. What I mean by that is, in your gameplay, I think that a lot of people have some understanding of this. So a very common example, right? Someone attacks with their 2-drop, you have your own 2-drop or 3-drop or whatever it is, and you don't block even though you could because you realize you might have an opportunity to set up a better block later. And that, like, if they have in this format, let's say a Gaia's Gift, it could be potentially very bad for you. So you take damage realizing, okay, as long as you have some life over, you can win the game. Right. And that's a very common thing that people do, and something that there's a certain understanding of amongst a lot of people that play limited Magic. But I think that you can take that concept and apply it to other things as well, either other gameplay decisions or based very much on like your deck building. How much card advantage do I need to win, or how much do I really need to be low on my curve in order to make my strategy work? And how much can I afford to play something bigger in my low to the ground strategy just so that I have a way to finish? And all these things can depend on a lot of things like your matchups and the format. And I think that that discussion is a really useful one to have and to know that you can be having to make those decisions.
One of the things you said was that not drafting for quote unquote synergy in scenarios where one of the pieces wins on its own. It's like trying to get too cute with something.
Yeah.
Hourglass Coven was an amazing card, right? And if you had some kind of blink strategy, then that's absurd. But if it's messing with the rest of your deck to add that in, you don't really need to do that.
Yeah, exactly. That was an example that I had. I know it's maybe a little bit dated from here. For anyone who doesn't know the card, Hourglass Coven was basically, for all intents and purposes, just a card that you cast and has insane ETB, like Enter the Battlefield trigger. And it was extremely strong. And so my thought was like, I saw people do this a lot in this format. And for one thing, it's a fun thing to do. So not to knock anyone for doing it, because sometimes, I mean, we just play to have fun. So it's not that you shouldn't be doing it. But in the interest of winning, if you think about what has to happen in order for you to blink your coven, not only do you have to have the coven and the blink, most importantly, you have to have cast and resolved the coven. So the way I see it, what percentage of the games are you resolving coven and otherwise would lose that now the blink is going to win you the game, right? Because if you resolve that card, which again, for people not familiar, it was pretty much one of the biggest bombs in that set. And I think by stats in recent Magic history, if you resolve it, you're already winning that game a massive, massive percentage of the time. And so now you've included this card in your deck that isn't so great otherwise so that you can win more. And so you're sacrificing some consistency so that you can win by a lot, when in fact you didn't need to. You could have played another 2-drop, or you could have even just played, I don't remember exactly what was in that format. Let's say there's like a bounce spell, right? So you can actually have that same kind of interaction a little bit less efficiently for that interaction, but that might save you because you can bounce their flyer and not die to it earlier on, making you more likely to be able to live to cast the coven. I think an example from this format, just to have something a little more recent, let's say you have a Titania's Command and you think, oh yeah, so it's great because I can add counters to my creatures, and you think, oh well, there's synergy, I can draft, I don't remember the name, there's like a 6-mana white card that makes 4/1/1s.
Mass production,
thank you. And so I think it's a little less something you would try to do in this instance. The synergy is less obvious. But the point is that, like, if you put that in your deck so that you can make your Titania's Command better, again, you're thinking about, well, would you have lost that game if you just cast the Titania's Command in a normal game of Magic anyways? Probably not. And so there's a discussion to be had there. Did you need to do that to win? Because it doesn't help you to win by more.
Winning by 20 and winning by exact is the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And there are scenarios where you need to go that much over the top. And that's more something considered like in best of three with sideboarding. But in a normal best of one game, if you just play your normal curve and resolve Titania's Command, you're probably going to win. If you missed out on a spot because you were playing mass production over a 2-drop, you're not in as good of a spot, because then you're playing that and you might be on the back foot and lose enough of those guys before the command anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of the other things you put as examples were like the Specimen and Vow and Dreadfeast Demon. Like, if you play Dreadfeast Demon and it sits there till the end of turn so you get to get a second one, it's very rare that you're going to lose in that point.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sure, getting to sit there and keep bringing back specimen multiple times and with the triggers on the stack is pretty cool, but you had 12 power in flying already, and if you had anything else. So if that specimen doesn't work with anything else in your deck, is it really necessary?
Exactly. I think that's a great example.
If your whole thing is, I need to stall the Dreadfeast Demon because I don't have any other way to win, then sure, specimen's a viable thing in that case. But it's, you have to think about things like that when making these decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Another thing you talked about was, if your top end is enough to beat 90% of the decks in the format, you don't need to play your extra big creature. Just play a 2-drop instead.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are situations where this doesn't apply, like OG Dominaria Sealed, where you're just better off playing as many 6-drops and just winning in the long game. But as far as in the normal situation, you don't need to, in best of one, be prepared for, oh, well, if I have this in my deck, I can go over the top of these 10%, when you just want to be over the top of 90% of the decks.
Exactly right. So as you mentioned, the example of Dominaria Sealed, I think that this is where the format can influence a lot of the decision making here, right? Because in that format, what would be enough to be, let's say, again, the number I happen to use was like 90% of decks, right? It requires more of you to do that than in, you know, some other format. And so that's part of the kind of internal discussion you want to have and calibration that you figure out, okay, how much do I need to win in this format or in this, you know, play environment? And it changes from format to format. But an example I would use is, if you take a card out of one format and place it into another, and you can compare like the changes that would happen. So an example I thought of is, imagine the card Blossom Prancer from Neon Dynasty. Mm-hmm. And if you take that card and you put it into Bro Draft, let's say you do an artifact version of it, right? Where it can grab an artifact or a creature or whatever, or gain you 4 life. That card would be heinous. And I mean, it was already very absurd in the format it was in. But like, by comparison, you could cast that card and not just win the game in Neo sometimes, because there were decks that drew so many cards or generated so much value, whether it was the Blue Saga. Yeah, Behold, or other Blossom Prancers, or people just generating value by like ninjaing and all these things. There were ways to go really big in that format and get even something as powerful as a strong body on efficient mana that draws a card or gets a creature. As insane as it was, it by itself wasn't always enough to win in that format. If you transfer that card to a format like Bro, where yes, there are ways to pull ahead on cards, but they're not as plentiful relative to the format, all of a sudden that card gets a boost. The idea being then, we want to consider not just kind of in a vacuum how strong a card is, or in even as a deck, consider how much a deck is capable of doing, but also considering how much that occurs relative to the rest of the format.
When we're talking about this, one of the cards to consider is, say, the 1/4 lifelinker, right? Do you want another 6-drop that is going to help you get over the top of whatever the biggest deck is? Or do you want that 3-drop that you can drop in early that's going to stall against the lower end decks that'll let you win with your slightly higher top end?
Yep. Great example. Oh, do you mind if I add something into about, I had thought about something involving like how it affects mulligans too.
Okay, go ahead.
As an additional point too, I would say that this idea of considering how much you need to win and your matchups and the format, it can tie in heavily to your mulligan decisions too, which I think are oftentimes some of the most overlooked decisions as far as how often people win and one of the most important skills you can have when you're playing limited. For example, I'm going to mulligan differently if I'm playing against a slower, grindier deck than if I'm mulliganing against a aggressive red-white deck, because it takes less to win against the red-white deck with regard to how much cards you generate, and you win in a different way. So for example, if I'm playing against a slow deck and I keep a hand with 5 lands, 2 generic creatures, my deck doesn't have a great way to generate a bunch of value. That's not so good, right? Because from a game plan perspective, they're going to go over the top of me and I'm probably not going to be able to keep up. Comparatively, my plan against, let's say, an aggressive red-white deck, I don't need to get ahead on as many cards. Now, maybe you don't keep the 5-lander anyways, but the point being that I don't need as much to beat a red-white deck. And that's not to say that the red-white deck is worse, but that their game plan is different. They're not going to be able to keep up on cards with me on average. Now, maybe they have a pile of discs and I misjudge that. And that can happen. And that's part of the decision-making process, right? And you calibrate by saying, okay, did I make a bad decision here? Should I expect the red-white deck to have 4 discs? Probably not. Should I lose to them having 1? Well, I mean, maybe it's not unreasonable to think they could have 1, right? And so like, you think about things in this way and you say, okay, how much do I need to win and how do I most consistently achieve that? And so I think it can affect the way that you make your decisions when you mulligan as well.
on those decisions, I think one thing that people don't think about enough is, why did they lose like that? And if you had the right thought process and you went down the right thing and you recognized that there was a decision to be made there and you thought about the different things, and then it just, you drew four lands in a row at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
But you felt like you made the right plays along the way and you just lost to a flood. You shouldn't go, oh, this matchup was bad, or I lost because I made this decision. That's variance.
Yeah, definitely important to identify the reasons you lost when you're making those, not even the decision, like the assessment, I guess I would say,
right,
as to how much you need to win. If you haven't honestly and objectively assessed why you lost or won in the past, then it becomes even more difficult to calibrate that.
Process versus results. I know in the long run, I'm going to win more by following the right process than I am by just going, oh, cool, I won because I top decked this. It's cool when I'm like, hey, I realize my only way to win is to do this, block here, draw this card next turn, kill that. You set up like two or three turns of, you're like, this is my only possible path to win, and they have to be these three top decks in a row. And you do it, and that's amazing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome.
But people don't go, oh, well, that was perfectly played. They're like, oh, how lucky. And it's like, no, that was putting myself in that position.
And getting lucky.
Right. If you're not in the position to get lucky, that's on you. And that's a good amount of percentage that people throw away by not trying to figure out their outs. Mm-hmm. Even if it's absurd, you should spend the time and figure it out.
Yeah, for sure.
But back on some, so you said it's better to have a slight edge over everything or closer to even matchups game one than to build so that you crush slow decks but lose the fast ones or vice versa.
Yeah. When you consider your deck construction, a lot of times you want to stand somewhere in the middle with regard to your game plan. When I say in the middle, I mean you want to build in a way where your limited deck isn't going to have highly volatile matchups. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily you build everything as a mid-range, right? Because if you're playing a super low to the ground red-white deck, or you're playing like the Blast Runner deck, then you're still not going to have super volatile matchups, even though you're trying to go really fast or sneak under people, because what you're doing doesn't often care that much about what your opponent is doing. And so in that way, you're playing a balanced game plan, right? But if when you're building your slower deck, right, and you have a lot of value, and so because you have a lot of value, if you're both sitting there casting two mana cantrip artifacts and doing nothing, and you built your deck so you can crush them because you have a billion Stern Lessons or whatever, right? Then that's kind of making a concession that you'd rather not on average. Just because, again, whenever you pair up and match up with someone, you don't know what matchup you're going to get. So building in a way where you have some real play versus all the strategies that are common in the format is going to be a better way forward, because then you can stand to win those by a small amount. We don't care that we crush some matchups if we're losing half the time to something else.
In best of one, it's really polarizing because of how the matchups go. And I've seen so many people that post decks and they're like, why did this trophy, or why did this not trophy? And they don't ever consider, hey, maybe because you just built this to only beat this type of deck.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get the wrong ideas. Instead of going, okay, that was variance in the matchup, they just go, oh, well, this crush, this is the best deck ever, so I'm just going to run it, try to build this deck every time. That same deck could go 7-0 or 2-3.
Absolutely.
Putting yourself in the position to have better matchups overall is really helpful.
Best of one in particular, and it's slightly off topic, but I think that, yeah, it's oftentimes drastically underestimated how much variance can play a role there. Like, you can take the same deck, and if you ran it through 10 events, you could get anything from several trophies to several 1 or 0 wins, and even piloted by good players, like, that can happen, I think.
Yeah, you'll see it. A lot of the streamers, they're like, oh, sorry, you know, didn't think this was a 1-3, but apparently it is.
Yeah.
While in best of three, we have the huge advantage of sideboarding properly, because you're like, okay, this matchup is slower, so I do want to bring in these extra certain lessons that I grabbed for the board. Or I just need to cut a land here because I'm at the draw. Or there's so many little things that you can do in the sideboard plan to craft your deck more towards winning.
Yeah, absolutely.
But best of one, you just have to be.
Yeah, that's definitely some upsides. I still play best of ones, not exclusively. I mostly play best of threes, but occasionally just because the lower time commitment, right? That said, I think there is less depth in the best of one decision making.
You have anything else you want to add to this section?
Nope, that's it.
All right. Cool play of the week. Gould 100 used Might Stone's animation to animate their own Altar of Dementia to sacrifice it to itself to finish milling their opponent out. Do you have a bad beat of the week by chance?
Sorry. I feel like I've earned all my losses recently.
Fair. All right, do you have anything that you'd like to plug? Perhaps your YouTube videos you've been putting up?
Nah, no one likes to watch those. It's fine. Appreciate it, though.
You're the only person I've ever met that's like, nah, nah, don't promote me. I do this stuff, but I don't want to promote it.
Yeah, I mean, I just do it for fun, and because sometimes it's a good thought process for me to go through and think about my drafts. But yeah, it's not something that's a high priority.
All right. Come check out our totally free Discord where you can get deck techs, pick advice, check out trophy decks, discuss limited, or just chill. You can find the Draft Lab on Twitch at J2SJosh when hell freezes over, Floridamon, Icky, EagleTV, to Jordan and DeFore. Don't forget to check out MTGAZone.com for awesome strategy gargles by the Draft Lab. Well, that's 68 episodes in, and next episode's gonna be nice.